You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. You are being tracked. Your actions are being tracked by government, retailers, credit agencies, social media, and it all goes a lot deeper than you might realize. Jonathan Weinberg is a professor of law at Wayne State University, and he recently wrote an article for The Conversation, which outlines surveillance of you now and where it might go in the future, and he joins us now. You start out by writing, surveillance used to be expensive, but today it's a lot cheaper to keep tabs on people, even those who are not suspected of any kind of trouble. What's changed?
What's changed, most importantly, is digital technology. Back in the day, if government wanted to see where you were going, they would have to detail three shifts of people, 8 hours at a time, 24 hours a day, to stake out your house and actually follow you. And they could do that legally because everywhere you went was public, but it took a lot of resources. These days, government can set up license plate readers. If they have a warrant, they can just slap a transponder on your car. What's changed is that that's so much cheaper that it's plausible to do it a huge amount more in connection to a lot more people. And then the results just flow automatically into easily searchable and manipulable digital databases.
So they can use facial recognition, the license plates that you mentioned. You know, when I was reading it, I was thinking about the Green Light Initiative in Detroit, where they're using high-definition cameras at a lot of businesses all over the city. Well, if you wanted to keep tabs on somebody, that feed goes directly to the police department. It'd be pretty easy to do it with a whole system of that citywide.
No, that's absolutely right. And we're seeing that, say, in London. London, something that's been a boon to law enforcement is that the city is absolutely covered with closed-circuit TV cameras, both governmental and private. And, you know, that's great if you're trying to figure out who left the bomb. But it also means that nowhere you've gone is secret. It's all out there. Anyone with access to that information can track you. And again, what makes that possible is that it's pretty straightforward to take everybody's closed-circuit TV coverage and just combine it into a single searchable database.
You stress the data gathered about us can be used in making decisions about our credit, our employment, government benefits. And then you note that the data might be misinterpreted, leading government and companies to have inaccurate ideas of who we actually are when making those decisions. Can you give me an example how that might play out?
Well, we're seeing a lot of decisions being made about people on the basis of information in their files. Problem is that information in the files about people, you know, simply isn't correct all the time. That's not a matter of misinterpreting it. It's just that it's wrong. And when you think about it, that's not really so surprising. You know, large organizations make a lot of mistakes, and data entry in particular is subject to a lot of mistakes. But, you know, you find, elderly people getting mailings from Walmart about, you know, congratulations on graduating high school. Here are the deals we can offer you. That's completely harmless. Not so much of a problem if you end up deported because the government's lost the information that proves you're a citizen.
Right. I know that as a reporter, you know, I delve into a lot of things that in my personal life I wouldn't be interested in at all, perhaps. And then suddenly I get ads related to that popping up in Facebook, and I think, wow, they're really keeping track. I mean, you wrote that Facebook can follow a user's web browsing even if they're not logged into Facebook at the time. How does that happen, and how does that benefit Facebook?
One of Facebook's key assets is the information it has about its users, in part because it can monetize that information by allowing advertisers to target ads to Facebook users. If I'm selling speedboats, I don't necessarily want to spray my ads out across the world at large. I want to get my ads to people who are actually likely to buy speedboats, and Facebook can help me do that. So in a lot of ways, the most important commodity across the World Wide Web are the eyeballs and attentions of readers, of viewers. But basically, the notion is if you're not paying, you're the product. And the viewers here, they're the product. They're what's being sold in the web economy.
So an ad at the side for Facebook. That seems innocuous enough. But you note that Facebook combines its data with information from data brokers such as the credit agency Experian. How much do they know about us because of that trading of data, combining of data, mingling, and the larger picture of us?
They know a great deal, although, again, some people might consider this a saving grace. A lot of what they know is wrong. Facebook is delighted to sell you a list of recently married people in Oregon who are in the market for a minivan because they've got the data points that enable them to do them. Folks out there have the data points to sell a list of people on diabetes medication or people not currently on diabetes medication who might be in the market for that soon. All of that information is out there. It's sellable. In the right markets, you can easily purchase it. All of this is legal. On the other hand, at least right now, not all of the information is accurate. So you may get your diabetes medication ads, even though, thankfully, this is not your problem.
About those mistakes, about those errors, you note in Europe, an ordinary person can go see their own digital profiles. They can access that. But in the U.S., we cannot. So what could we do with that information if we did have access to it?
In Europe, has broad-ranging data privacy laws that across the board place really sharp, sweeping limitations on what so-called data proprietors, on what people who have access to information about you can do with that information, the circumstances under which they can keep that information, the access they need to give you to that information. The U.S. has no such laws. The U.S. has some very specific privacy laws relating to specific sectors. It's got a health information privacy law. It's got a law maintaining the privacy of the videos you rent from the video rental store, which made more sense back in the day when there existed such a thing as video rental stores. It does have a law giving you access to your profiles at the major credit agencies, at folks like Experian, TransUnion. And you do indeed have the right to get your file from them for free periodically so you can check for errors, and you have a right to transmit any errors you find to them. And indeed, that's something I recommend that everyone do, because Experian may think that you're carrying all sorts of credit card debt that doesn't actually exist, that could impact, say, your ability to get loans, that could impact what you need to pay to get loans in some pretty harmful ways.
But beyond those few restrictions you just mentioned, any other mistakes that companies or the government have that paint us to be a different person than we actually are, we can't even go and find out about it and correct it?
Absolutely right.
You say it's already possible that companies might charge higher prices to some people rather than others based on any number of attributes in the way that auto insurance already does. Tell us how that might work with other products we want to buy.
Well, one place that we're definitely seeing that right now is Amazon. I may not see the same price that you see when we're logged into Amazon and looking at the same products, because Amazon knows enough about us that, you know, its algorithm generates one price for you and another price for me.
Sure. Well, lawyers make a lot more money than public radio reporters, so that's good enough, right? I win. But that's an amazing thing when you think about it, because we all think we're getting a fair shake on this, and you're saying that may not be the case.
But more generally, I mean, stuff that may not be so endearing as lawyers getting charged higher prices. One of the things we're seeing is folks charging higher prices, paradoxically, to people who live in poor neighborhoods, because people who live in poor neighborhoods may have fewer bricks and mortar options for that particular product and are stuck with buying online in a way that people in richer neighborhoods don't. And at that point, people who have less money actually end up paying more online by virtue of the fact that the sellers know more about them and know that they have fewer options.
It's like economic redlining.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think more generally, one of the things we're seeing is that the more vendors and service providers know about us, the more they have the opportunity to treat us differently based on factors that used to be lumped in the category of none of your business. That a vendor may think, you know, I'm a worse credit risk because I've had marriage counseling. I haven't had marriage counseling. It's a hypothetical. Mom, dad, don't worry. A vendor may think I'm a worse credit risk because I've had marriage counseling and end up being more reluctant to give me a loan or to charge me a higher price. And that's simply, I think, not good for us as a society.
I think most people would just see that as wrong in general, not fair, something that should be monitored. So in your conclusion, you talked about we need to talk about government enacting some rules constraining or containing some of this activity. How's that going to happen?
Well, there are two questions bundled up in that. One is, what would it look like? And the second is, could this really happen in the United States? And I think the obstacles to broad-ranging privacy legislation in the U.S. are really powerful because we've allowed a potent, lucrative sector of the economy to grow up around selling people's information.
Sure, Google and Facebook are going to lobby pretty hard against any restrictions.
And those folks aren't going to give in without a fight on restrictions on what they can do. That said, even though there are flaws and problems associated with European-style privacy legislation, what really drives the information economy in the U.S. and what drives the potential for the sort of discrimination I've described is the fact that we don't have across-the-board privacy rules the way Europe does. And maybe the answer isn't that. Maybe the answer is that we need to think smaller, because we're not going to get European privacy-style rules, and there are reasons why we might not want them even if we could get them. But perhaps we should think more about sectoral legislation. Maybe we want to think more about what credit cards and banks can take into account in deciding whether they grant you a loan. The Federal Trade Commission has an inquiry going right now on what should be in bounds, what should be out of bounds for lending decisions. And that's really, I think, something that it's important not to ignore.
Jonathan Weinberg is a law professor at Wayne State University and has published numerous articles on internet and high technology law and policy, including the article we've been discussing, which is titled The Real Costs of Cheap Surveillance. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.